Catherine Rollwagon, Professor of History at Vancouver Island University. Welcome to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. We introduce you to the people and passions of the Faculty of Arts and Humanities at VIU and share stories about events and projects happening on campus. Since 2009, the Faculty of Arts and Humanities has been presenting the Colloquium, a series of lectures that brings our faculty's practices and research to the public. Our next presentation will be on Friday, February 7th, when Marnie Stanley, Interim Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Humanities and Professor in the Department of Studies in Women and Gender, presents Graphic Refugees, the Trauma of the Displaced Self. Today, Theo Finnegan sits down with Marnie to talk about comics and her recent work as Dean of the Faculty.
Hi, Marnie.
Hi, Theo.
Nice to see you.
It's good to see you, too.
Have you always been into reading and or teaching graphic narratives? And what draws you to that genre?
Nice pun on draws. I always liked comics. I liked them as a child, but I didn't have parents who really approved of comics other than the Classics Illustrated. So I was allowed to read, you know, Robinson Crusoe as a comic. But one summer, when my mother was tired of so many children, she sent the two youngest to one of her sisters. And that aunt did not mind me spending all my pocket money on comics.
Wow.
So I had a marvelous summer when I was 12 of reading any comic in the corner store. And I read Ghost comics and children's comics like Archie and Sugar and Spike. And I smuggled as many home as I could. But then I didn't start reading comics again until I was at grad school. And that classic comic year of 1984, when The Dark Knight and Mouse and Watchmen were all published. But I didn't actually teach comics until many years later because, A, there was quite a lot of resistance in English departments in North America, more resistance than in Europe. And also because there weren't courses where I could sort of fit them in. And then I started fitting them in even in courses where they didn't sort of belong because I could find, for example, nonfiction comics to add to English composition, or I also teach in women's studies or studies in women and gender as it is now. And there were many comics that dealt with issues relevant to that, social justice comics and things like that. So I kept sneaking them in until eventually I was allowed to develop a comics course. But that was only about 10 years ago.
What was in that course? Do you remember what which kinds of texts you taught?
Well, I've taught three separate comics courses, one focusing just on Canadian comics, one focusing internationally, so including things like manga and mangua and so on, and then another focusing just on women artists.
How do they go over in the classroom for the students? Do they enjoy reading them sometimes more than reading written texts, or what's your sense of that?
It really depends on the student. Some students are comic readers. I always start by asking how many people are habitual readers of comics or at least read them for some period of their life. And other students really struggle to bother to pay attention to the imagery. They read them as text and they don't notice the visuals. And so you have to constantly remind them, and you have to remind them that their assignments must engage visually with the comic and not to read it as a script. So some students naturally come to that right brain, left brain balance of the comic book, and others stay with the left brain and stay with language, and it's harder for them to pay attention to the visuals.
A comic like Watchmen, which I've read and taught, it's so plot-driven on the one hand,
yes,
and the visuals kind of, and to that extent, kind of back up the narrative, but it's so intricate as well visually, right, where there's these motifs that of, you know, the clock hands, but also other things that look like clock hands.
Like the happy face.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Which you can't, it's like, you know, analyzing a film, you have to pay attention to the visuals as well.
And if you look at the opening page of his script, Alan Moore is one of the most obsessive script writers. The opening page is a discussion of the very first panel. And he takes a whole page of the script to say what kind of angle he wants, how far away he wants the subject to be.
Wow.
And he has a complete visual sensibility about how this comic's going to look. And you have a whole issue of the original 12-issue split of The Watchmen. I think it's number 6, where the whole comic reverses on itself.
Mm.
So halfway through the whole rest of it becomes the exact opposite. That whole issue is a mirror, and the frames are exactly the same going the other direction in their framing and composition, but the script and the plot is moving forward.
Oh, wow.
So you have these incredibly intricate things that are medium specific that only comics can do, because unlike film, and sometimes people think they're like film, but they're not, because in film, the speed is set by the projector and it's not in control. I mean, now we can stop and we can back up and stuff, but generally speaking, when we see cinema in the cinema, the speed is not in our control. We can't stop and look. We can't back up. And comics can fill the frame. They can change. They can use the gutter. The gutter is not visible in film. It's a visible and a thing in comics, the space between the panels. So all of that makes comics a very specific medium, and we need to learn to read it as a specific medium. So returning to your earlier question about students, some students have already built some of those skills by reading comics. But some students try to transfer film reading to comics. And again, there's a kind of difference. They need to learn what's specific to comics and what the capacity of comics is to express things.
Do you find there can sometimes be a drawback to having built up that knowledge already, having, say, had a history reading comics as a fan, then coming to reading them academically? So that if there's a drawback to being a student who has no comics knowledge at all, and you're trying to read it in a way that doesn't suit, versus sort of maybe being invested in a character that then doesn't facilitate kind of critical reading. Have you ever had that experience?
I haven't had it very much, because I tend to teach relatively obscure comics. So people tend not to be familiar with those specific comics. Also, I have a particular love of autobiographical comics, and those aren't the most commonly circulated and tend not to be the ones people have read as fans.
Right.
So then I'm adding the genre of autobiography to the discussion of comics and so on. So generally speaking, I don't find that students' fandom gets in the way, because fandom is generally a positive and pleasant thing.
Sure.
And so enthusiasm can always be added to by having some theory or having some knowledge, but it doesn't detract from their experience or their capacity in any way.
So your talk in the colloquium coming up is about graphic narrative in relation to things like trauma and displacement and the experience of refugees. I wondered if you could speak to the power of images to convey those kinds of experiences. I'm thinking in particular, just as an example, of that gut-wrenching image from a few years ago of the little boy on the beach who had drowned. You know, the power of an image to convey an experience in a way maybe that words can't always do it, but maybe also the limitations of that.
Well, of course, just to answer your question from the end, one limitation in some people's minds, not in mine, is that these are made images. And so when we think of comics as a form of documentation, and they are documents, literally, they are individual made images in a sequence. If somebody says, well, it's a made image, they just drew that, they can put in what they like. But we can say that a documentary film is also a made image. A documentary film has cutting and editing. It can also have recreation of scenes. It can have removal of people that were present but not in the frame, and so on. So we need to think of all of our documentation as made things. Right? And so I don't find comics necessarily have a disadvantage, and they can create imagery of things that no one documented. Now, it's true that modern refugees and migrants, and I use both terms because I'm not making a legal distinction between who's a refugee and who's a migrant. The government has specific ways of making that distinction. I don't make that distinction. All of these are people who don't feel their country can work for them anymore, that they can live there happily or safely. So I'm not making that distinction. Some of these are migrant comics and some are refugee comics. And some of them are made by witnesses and some are made by the actual person to whom the experience occurred. Some are made through an interview process and so on. I think they allow things to be told that are hard to tell, even though contemporary refugees and migrants often do document their own stories. And some of them do podcasts and vlogs and other ways of telling their story and showing the conditions in which they they live. But I think comics can help people take an experience which is very much in other people's control, where they're the objects of governments and bureaucrats and systems, and allow them to tell their story to somebody or to tell it themselves, depending. Some of these are, as I say, done by witnesses and journalists. And then they become subject instead of object. And I think that's very important. And I think comics, on the one hand, they can show us stories that allow us to sympathize. But sympathy is a fairly distant reaction, and it allows us to feel unconnected in a way. Sympathy is something you feel for someone. It's not a responsibility. But some of these comics also help us understand the geopolitical situations that led to these crises and help us understand the ways in which our countries, our foreign policies, our colonial practices, and other things, both historical and contemporary, have led to these situations. And so they move us from a distance of sympathy to helping us to see the ways in which we are culpable.
It makes me think of a film, so not a comic, but an animated film that is also a documentary called Waltz with Bashir. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah. Which was also a comic book first.
It was, huh?
Or was it a comic book second? I can't remember, but it exists as a comic book.
It exists as a film. Yeah. But it does such a great job of both documenting a historical, you know, an actual historical event that happened to the main character and to other people. But also, I think the thing that I like about it is the way it enables both documentation but also probing questions of representability and, you know, what is difficult to represent? Why is it difficult to represent? Are there other ways of representing it that might bring you closer to an event, perhaps? And there's that amazing moment where it becomes actual footage. Around a massacre in Beirut in Lebanon, and there's a moment of actual documentary footage that sort of comes out of nowhere, and it's an incredible moment of sort of confrontation of something that actually happened in the way we would normally understand it, right, an indexical form, a film of something, kind of interrupting a more obvious representation, and it's really cool moment.
It's like the single photograph in Mouse, right? In the two volumes of Mouse, there's the one photograph of his father in his Auschwitz uniform, except it isn't his Auschwitz uniform. It's him posing for a photographer in the camp. So it's this kind of very odd representation, misrepresentation, but it's also documentation, and it says something about his father's feelings as a survivor. Mm. But also about this way of people needing to authenticate something that they can't authenticate any other way. And there are a number of nonfiction comics that insert literal documentation. There's a comic called Cancer Vixen, for example, where she's writing about her cancer experience as an uninsured American prior to their contemporary Obamacare. And she puts actual photographs of her bills and various other things into the comic. And she also has a single photograph and various other things, you know, scientific drawings of the cells and the needles and so on, to create this sense of authenticity and documentation. And there is always that challenge to the refugee or migrant. Is your story authentic? Are you just making this up to come to our fabulousness, you know?
And the kind of Don Cherry view of things.
Yes, exactly. And it's a constant battle. Is your story the right story? And we're not acknowledging that these are people whose countries have abandoned them in many ways. Mm. The country's not functional. It's not safe, perhaps just for the group of people which they are, based on religious or sexual difference or some other category, or based on the complete collapse of the country into warfare or drought or poverty. And so we're not, we have an expectation of truth telling, but we also have this sensibility that we're all the immigrant judge, you know, we're all deciding whether somebody's story is true or not. And so they're up against this wall of people expecting untruth from them, this wall of doubt. And so how can they convey the story, or how can the witness, such as the journalist who's trying to tell it, convey the story in a way that is persuasive and authentic?
Calimera. It's Eliza Gardiner from the theater department at Vancouver Island University. You're listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities on CHLY 101.7 FM, Nanaimo.
Changing tack a little bit, so that your presentation, I believe, is part of Global Citizens Week at VIU.
That's correct.
What's the significance of this week for VIU? Can you speak a little bit to the importance of thinking globally for us as an institution at VIU?
Well, VIU has 1 week each term where it focuses on VIU in the world as a global citizen. And the first one in the fall term is just World VIU Days, and it's more the sort of party version. It's the first term, it's welcome, it's full of music and celebration and color and fashion shows and things like that. Whereas in the second term is the kind of serious version. So now we're into the year, we're down to work. How are we as a global citizen? So that use of the term citizen is about things like the geopolitical analysis, right? What is the reasons for this happening? Not just the facts, but analysis, bringing critical thinking, bringing consciousness to what we're doing as global citizens, not just that we have international students or we have global studies, but individually, how are all of us part of, how is Canada part of, how is British Columbia part of this global system where we have, you know, foreign policy actions, we have historic participation in various colonial wars and other things that have created these current instabilities, these current crises. And so Global Citizens Week is full of lectures and films and presentations such as this one that ask people to think about and analyze and contemplate our role and contemplate actions also. So if you go to the university webpage and look up Global Citizens Week, you'll see all kinds of activities, many of them open to the public, such as special film screenings, lectures, and so on, that ask those bigger picture questions.
So you're a professor in the VIU English department as well as in Studies in Women and Gender. You're also currently Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Humanities. How are these two jobs different? Do you like one better than the other? Do you prefer one over the other? Pros and cons?
Yeah, I think I will talk about the difference, but not the preference, because it's an apples and oranges question.
Right.
I'm the current acting dean, and I've been in that role for a little over a year and a half. And I have 30 years of teaching prior to that and 25 years at VIU. So I have a lot of teaching, and I'm still doing a little bit of teaching. I have a directed studies this term, and I taught one course last year when I was dean, and I'm planning to teach one next year. Keeping that hat on, and I still have things that I'm writing, such as this presentation. And so the parts of the job overlap. The piece that's different is that it's sort of like the focus versus the big picture. So when you're in a single department or in two departments, as I was, your focus is on the health and well-being of those departments. Your focus is on the students that take those subjects and your colleagues in those disciplines. And you interact with the deans and other administrators for the benefit of your program. But in the dean's role, you're advocating for all 11 of the programs in the arts and humanities, and it's one of the biggest faculties. If you walk through my office, you'll see there's books in almost all these disciplines, and I always took an interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary approach. When I taught historic literature, such as the Victorians, I always made sure that my students understood the political context that these writers were writing in, and that they always had some interaction with the other arts of the same period. So if I was teaching a poet like Swinburne, I'd bring in all the great decadent painters, some of the most radical music of the day. Sometimes I'd bring in other people to help teach those things if it was things I wasn't very skilled at. And I'd show film clips that showed recreations of those historic moments and so on. So I've always had that basically magpie brain. Mm. There's that old chestnut that says that scholars are either foxes or hedgehogs. I'm a total hedgehog. Like the fox is the person with a single focal point, like the great Shakespearean scholar who can recite almost the entire works of Shakespeare and knows everything about Shakespeare and his context, but doesn't have a lot of other interests. I've always been, my master's supervisor said of me that I had too many knives and none of them were sharp. And ever since, I've always thought, I've got a lot of knives. I'm not sure I like the metaphor of knives because it's a little violent, but I take her point that I perhaps lack focus from her point of view. But that lack of focus is actually a skill in this job because it means I genuinely have interest in the disciplines and I genuinely can support them from a knowledge position. Although, of course, compared to the faculty who teach these individual disciplines, I'm a piker, but I still like their discipline and I know enough to represent it accurately.
Could you give us some must-reads as recommendations for people listening?
What are some
crucial ones that we should have on our bookshelves?
I think the most important thing for people to understand is that comics have a whole bunch of genre. As I say, I have a preference for nonfiction and especially autobiographical comics. And in the autobiographical comics, I would definitely say comics like Justin Green's Binky Brown, which was a sort of foundational comic, Alison Bechdel's Fun Home. And I have to say, just a little brag, I own a page of original Alison Bechdel art.
Oh, wow.
which thrills me every day when I walk down my hallway at home. And Jason Lutz, Berlin, three-volume. It took him, I think, 21 years to complete Berlin. Oh. It is a fantastic comic. And it's set in Berlin in the rise of the fascist era and really shows the complexity of the politics. And the thing about Lutz is he is just a spectacular artist as well. So the graphic quality of that work is amazing. Originally published, first as splits, which is the individual small comics, then as three volumes, now finally completed last year. So now published in a single volume work. Of course, many people would say that Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis is a really necessary comic and certainly feeds into the work I'm doing here in this colloquium, although I won't be talking about it since it's much published about and much discussed. I'm a big fan of Linda Barry. I think she's brilliant, and so does the MacArthur Foundation because they just gave her a genius grant, which made me so happy. Long time coming, but that was really wonderful. She did Marley's, and she did 100 Demons, and she's written lately a lot of comics about making comics, which is really fun. So if you're interested in trying to be a comic artist, she'd be a really good person to read. As well, Scott McCloud's also done really good work about writing comics, and he's also, of course, a comic maker. And there's others as well. So I think the thing is to explore. If you have a particular genre you like detective writing or mystery or Western, especially if you look also at the European translation of comics, I've been collecting. The Louvre Museum in Paris has been commissioning comic artists to do comics set in the Louvre, and they're fascinating.
You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. Thanks to Theo Finnegan and Marnie Stanley for their conversation. Technical production by Robin Davies. Music by Greg Bush. The Colloquium series will be back in March with Sasha Kerbler and John Lepage presenting Mendelssohn's Overture to a Midsummer Night's Dream, Fantasy as the Bottom Line. For more information, visit our website by going to ah.viu.ca and clicking Colloquium series. I'm Catherine Rollwagen. Thanks for listening.